You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison, and joining us now are experts from both sides of the state line. Marisa Crow is a professor of electrical engineering at the Missouri University of Science and Technology. She joins us by phone from there this morning. Good morning, Marisa.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. And Mary Rizak is a professor of chemical engineering at Kansas State University. She's the ConocoPhillips Professor of Sustainable Energy. Dr. Rizak, welcome to you.
Good morning. Thanks.
Let me ask both of you to say a word about how much energy we're actually using today in America, in Kansas and Missouri. And is that number growing or is it shrinking? Dr. Crow?
That number continues to grow, and it's very closely tied to population base and, economic development. Obviously, as we become more affluent as a country, we need and want more things that use energy. You can easily think 50 years ago, most households only had one car, they only had one television. And now if you look around, everybody has multiple cars. Pretty much everybody in the family above the age of 16 has their own car. Everybody has their own television. Everybody has their own laptop, which they, of course, have to charge. Everybody has a cell phone. Everybody has a microwave.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the things that we have are just more, energy consumption.
Dr. Rizak, are there numbers to support that? I mean, how dramatic is the increase?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely true. If you look at energy consumption over the past 100 years, you'd see that the world energy consumption, right, which is really the thing that we sort of have to care about because some of our resources for producing energy are limited, so we have to care not only what's happening in the U.S., but what's happening in the rest of the world. That has increased dramatically, and it's continuing to increase as Dr. Crow said, there's a strong tie between energy consumption and economic development. And so as the economies of countries in Asia start to accelerate, you see the energy consumption in that part of the world increasing at a very rapid rate. Specifically, the Department of Energy is estimating that the energy consumption worldwide will go up by another 50% in the next 20 years. So the rates have increased a lot in the past decades, and they're going to continue to increase as we move forward.
So I wonder then, we've been hearing about conservation for all of these years. I mean, ever since I was a kid, I know we've been told all the ways we need to try to save energy. Is it that those efforts are not having any effect, or is it that the demands are just outpacing those efforts? Dr. Crow?
It's a little bit of both. I think if you look at many aspects of our lives, certainly our automobiles are far more efficient than they used to be. We have all of the Energy Star appliances. Those are far more efficient than they used to be. And so I think we are, as a society, expecting things to be more energy efficient. But on the other hand, we also have a much higher level of want. I wouldn't say need, but we have a much higher level of want. And so they are two different, avenues that we're taking as a society. We are more efficient, but we also use more.
Mm-hmm. Mary Rizak at K-State, you, of course, work a lot on sustainable energy, and obviously there's a lot of different places where Americans get their energy from. These days, what are the primary sources of energy for us, and how is it changing?
Well, so the primary sources for energy in the U.S. and the world still remain very heavily focused on the use of oil and gas and coal. That's probably representing about 90-ish percent of all the energy consumed in the U.S. and worldwide. The remaining fraction, which is somewhere between 10 and 15%, are renewable sources. And those sources in the U.S. are about half of that energy is bioenergy, something coming from agriculturally produced biomass, could be trees or annual crops. And then in smaller fractions, we have hydroelectric, geothermal, solar, and wind, right? So that that whole spectrum of renewable energy represents about 10% of the energy that's currently being consumed. So it's a relatively small fraction. But on the other hand, if you look at new energy plant production, so new power plants built around the world in the past decade, about half of those installations are renewable energy installations. So we still are very heavily relying on petroleum and coal as our primary source of energy, but we're starting to transition into solar and wind and geothermal and biomass for opportunities for the future.
Yeah, we're talking about big money, right? I mean, this is not an inconsequential matter. Even 1 or 2% difference has a big impact on the nation's economy, right?
Very much so. Yeah, there are, you know, the cost of energy, the cost of power is probably the primary consideration for industrial production for consumers and decisions they make. And so power costs and energy costs are really critical to providing economic opportunities for the country.
So is it in the nation's economic interest, as you see it, as well as sort of the interest of the environment or the realities about energy resources, to be shifting more of that 90% of oil, gas, and coal to these alternatives? Or can we function as we are for the foreseeable future? And either one of you could answer these questions. Dr. Rizak?
You know, it depends how far out in the future you want to go. Certainly the coal, gas, and petroleum resources are finite, and so at some point we will not be able to function the way we're functioning. But even today, the amount of research which is going on and the amount of new development going on for development of renewable energy sources is being economically driven, right? There are markets that need this, and in certain markets, in certain applications, these renewable energy applications are economically superior to the conventional sources. Now, that's not always the case. Conventional sources have very large scales and have a long history for making them economically attractive. But as the technology develops, things like biomass and solar and wind, those costs are coming down at a very rapid rate. And I think in the end, as those costs come down, it really benefits all of us, because we still have the tremendous success that we have existed on through the petroleum and coal-based world, but we also now have opportunities to look at alternatives that might suit certain applications better, and in certain applications will be cheaper. And so that's really great for all of us, both from an economic perspective and from a more broad perspective relating to security and long-term to things like greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, let's talk about some of those alternatives, but let me also invite our listeners to join the conversation. Are there ways that you have sought to be more sustainable in the use of energy in your own life? Do you have ideas for what the nation and the world need to do about our current energy situation? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888, or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. We would love to hear from you. Dr. Crow, let's talk about one of the pieces of terminology we hear a lot about, especially from politicians these days, and that's clean coal. Does clean coal represent some sort of new alternative form of energy, or is that a rebranding of an old form of energy?
It's really a rebranding. You know, coal is coal. It's what you get out of the ground. And in amongst all of the carbon are many particulate matters, you know, many different kinds of minerals. What clean coal technology is really refers to the post-processing of the, you know, the exhaust or the waste that you would get out of a coal plant. So what you want to do is that there are many different technologies, both in how the coal itself is burned, and you can remove some of the particulate matter, you know, during that process, or, you know, you can remove the, you know, the bad particulate matter, you know, essentially as it goes through the stack, through what are called scrubbers. And so when we say clean coal technology, we're really talking about ways of cleaning the pollution that is produced from the coal as it is burned. And those technologies that exist, there is, you know, also continual research going on in doing that. But, you know, as we get back, you know, anytime you add post-processing to any, you know, anything, that's going to increase the cost.
Yeah. So I wonder then if this is just sort of a rebranding of an existing technology, and the newer technologies, whether it be solar or wind or biofuels, are only at 10%. Do any of those newer technologies present at this point any real promise to become a bigger portion of our nation's energy consumption?
I would say definitely. I want to be cautious here and say, you know, that there really is no silver bullet at this point. But I think, you know, as we diversify our energy portfolio, we continue to invest in developing new technologies such as, you know, such as wind, such as, you know, PV, such as concentrated solar. I think, you know, as we continue to drive those new technologies, as with all technologies, as we learn more about them, we get better materials, we do drive the price down. And so I think, you know, looking into the future, I think that we will see technologies that are not economic right now but will become economically viable, you know, really as we scale and get critical mass in those areas. And some of those areas, you know, could be wind, could be photovoltaics, could be concentrating solar, could be wave energy. You know, we really don't know right now what the one energy source of the future will be, or even if there will be the one energy source. I think we will have to rely on many different types, you know, just like we do now. And certainly, you know, we haven't said much about nuclear, but that's also a possible energy source, you know, a very reliable energy source of the future as well.
Sure. Dr. Crowe, is another way forward to change the ways we consume energy? So I know, for example, we've heard about the smart grid, the ways that different times and different places can consume energy at different levels, and how that might affect our energy use.
And that's certainly true. If you look at our electricity usage, you know, as a society, we consume different amounts of electricity throughout the day, throughout the diurnal cycle. Typically, we consume most of our energy in late afternoon and early evening, because, number one, that's when it's the hottest. If you're talking late afternoon and early evening is when everybody comes home, or most people come home, and they turn on all of their home appliances. And so the more energy you use, the more expensive, you're starting to use your more expensive plants, as opposed to what we call, you know, the baseline, which is the cheapest plants. So if we can devise ways, smart ways, using the smart grid of evening out, you know, that peak and that valley, then we can, you know, use it in a more economic manner, either by deferring it or just being smarter about how we use it.
Right. That's Marisa Crowe. She's going to stay with us through this short break that we need to take at this point. She's a professor at Missouri University of Science and Technology. We're also joined by Mary Rizak, professor from Kansas State University. We'll continue our conversation about energy, how we can use less of it, how we can get more of it more efficiently, and we'll talk about some big questions. What's stopping us from getting this all figured out? We'll also talk later about a new exhibit about energy at Science City at Union Station. So stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Welcome back. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking today about energy, and especially about energy usage and consumption, as well as ways that we can be more efficient as a society. We're talking with our guests, Dr. Marisa Crowe from the Missouri University of Science and Technology, and Dr. Mary Rizak. She's a professor at Kansas State University. Dr. Rizak, let me ask you this. Are there particular challenges that are keeping us as a nation from getting this figured out? It seems like it's been going on an awful long time.
Well, I mean, I think we have ideas on how to how to reduce energy consumption and to more efficiently produce energy at the large scale that we need it at. So technically, we know how to do both of those things, or at least we know how to make steps in the right direction. The challenge that we face is a little bit in infrastructure, right? So we use energy to drive our cars. We use energy to heat and cool and light our buildings. And if we want to improve on how we do that, if we want to make those processes more efficient, we have to change our cars. We have to buy new cars. We have to change the buildings that we live and work in. And so there is a very long time scale for making those changes. In the cars, we maybe are talking 5 to 10 years, and in the buildings, we maybe are talking 50 to 100 years before we're going to change those. And so we can make moves in the right direction, but those moves generally will cost us money. Right, so insulating your house, you know it's a great idea, but it costs you money, and so there has to be an incentive to do it. And in the United States, we've been very fortunate to have very inexpensive energy for a very long time. And so the economic incentive that it's going to save us energy costs isn't really that big for most, for the average family. And so as energy costs go up, that incentive will go up, and policy can change things, too. The federal government has provided tax incentives for you to do things like Energy Star appliances and insulation in your house. And those have started to have inroads. So I think we can start to make steps in the right direction, but there has to be an economic driver to do that for the average person or the average business owner. And to date, those economic incentives haven't been big enough to have large scale and engagement.
The goodness of their hearts is not enough reason.
Yeah, typically not.
Well, we've got some ideas from some of our listeners for alternative energy sources and questions about those. Let's start with Cesar in North Kansas City. Cesar, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing great.
Very well. So one of the things that we have to continue to push is definitely solar energy, along with changing the way that we use our lighting. I know that currently, we have great incentives from the power companies along with the government to go ahead and replace some of this lighting issues along with install solar and as a renewable energy. Unfortunately, we also have the energy companies pushing for change on the way the incentives are right now repositioned, and I think that we definitely need to continue to push for solar in a way that is renewable, advanced, and also is a great source of, continue to reduce our risk.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate the call. Marisa Crow, you hear these calls for financial incentives for not just for household users, but for businesses and others to use things like solar energy. Is this the way of the future?
Well, I think as with any new technology, I think that, the government incentives are a good way of getting people to start thinking about this and start, putting them on their, on their buildings, on their homes. As with all things, I think, eventually these incentives will go away. But in the short term, I think it's a really good move on the part of the government to get people starting to think about these things so that we can get critical mass and really get the technology moving forward. Because companies aren't going to start going into that business in a large way unless that they have the customer base.
Well, and
so that's a good way to build up the customer base.
Well, and that's actually something I want to ask you about is sort of companies are all tied up in this. So, I mean, and I don't mean to make an example of you, Dr. Rizak, but you sit in a chair that's endowed by ConocoPhillips, the ConocoPhillips Chair of Sustainable Energy. Businesses are all tied up in this. Everyone's got a dog in the fight. Does that make it hard for us to move forward in ways that ultimately might cut into the business, have an economic impact on oil companies?
Oh, I don't think so at all. I think some of the leaders in a number of these areas are what you would think of as traditional energy companies. Companies like ConocoPhillips and ExxonMobil and others in that arena recognize that they're very long term, and we might be talking hundreds of years. Success is going to depend on a complete transition away from the resource that they've been using, petroleum and coal, and into using other sources, right? And so they are some of the leaders in the development, or at least the evaluation, the research of new ideas, and they would, I think, be very happy to work in biomass or solar or wind if it was economically attractive. So, I do think that, as you mentioned before, the scale here is very large. The economic opportunities are very big, and so it's okay if we move away from petroleum-based sources into other sources, and the companies that are in this arena are going to make that transition and are going to be the leaders, I think. So I don't think there's any conflict there at all.
I guess I want to ask each of you this last question. If you were, I was going to say, if you were going to train young people in energy, but of course that is what you're doing in your college settings. But if even younger than that, if you were teaching kids, what would you most want them to know right now about energy and what it means for their lives, Dr. Crow?
Well, I think, the first thing is that we need to recognize is just how integral energy is to everything that we do. In many cases, electricity and certainly petroleum, they've grown up, turning on the switch and having their electricity there, or jumping in the car and being able to go someplace using petroleum. And so I think once they realize just how much our lives depend on having energy available, then we can take that next step and say, we rely on it so much, let's make sure that we're always using it in the best and most sustainable manner that we possibly can.
Dr. Rizak?
Yeah, I would echo those thoughts. And I think the one thing that I would try to help students understand is that there are options and where they can extract energy, right? Ultimately, the energy source that we have available is the sun, and that has provided all of the energy that we're using in one form or another. And so they have options on how to capture that and how to utilize that, and they have options in their day-to-day decisions in how they use the energy as it comes to them. And informing them on, the options for energy availability and for energy use, I think, will help them make better decisions long term and to be better citizens, make better policies that impact both the state, the nation, and the world in a positive way.
That's Dr. Mary Rizak. She's a professor of chemical engineering at Kansas State University. She is the ConocoPhillips Professor of Sustainable Energy. We also have Dr. Marisa Crow, the Fred Finley Distinguished Professor of Electrical Engineering at Missouri University of Science and Technology. Thank you both so much for spending some time with us this morning.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So to help us know a little bit more now about what kids are learning about these things here in the Kansas City area, We have Jeff Rosenblatt with us. He's the director of Science City and the Gottlieb Planetarium, Kansas City Science Center. Welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're also joined on the line, we will be in a moment, by Emily Johnson, a senior at Olathe North High School. And she has a very special role in what's going on right now at Science City. But let me start with you, Jeff. What is in the exhibit that has just opened? Tell us about this big new thing.
Yeah, well, we just opened on last Friday, the Science of Energy. It's an exhibit that Burns & McDonnell and the Milbank Foundation both helped sponsor. It was the culmination of this competition called Battle of the Brains that started, and we had the winning school, high school, which was Olathe North, back in November of 2011. And so since then, we've worked to put this exhibit together. We've consulted with the high school students on the winning team, and it's an exhibit that you can explore energy and its relationship to you in your everyday life, in the larger scheme of the city and the world. So one of the key marquee pieces in it is a large power wheel. It looks like basically a wheel that like a little hamster
like
would
a hamster,
run on.
Yeah. It's a human hamster wheel.
It's a human hamster wheel, but we call it the power wheel formally. And so you can get on that wheel and start running. And so all the chemical energy that's in your body transfers to mechanical energy as you're moving, which goes to the wheel, which then transfers to electrical energy and lights up a sign. So people can see an immediate result of what they're doing. So they kind of get a relationship, and they see how many calories they just burned, and then they see how that kind of equates to how many watts they just produced. So they kind of get a feel for maybe what it really takes, what watts are compared to what you do every day.
So in other words, it's doing what the professors we just heard who teach this for a living want to see kids learning. They wanted them to have more awareness of how important energy is to everything they do.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a real neat attractor to the area, and definitely will probably be one of our more popular areas as we get going with the exhibit. Some other pieces in the exhibit are there's three bike stations, so it's just regular bikes on bike stands. And there's a little generator on the back wheel, and you can get on that and pedal. And up on a table in front of you is just an everyday object like a fan or a light. And you can see how much power it takes, how much effort on your part it takes to power that device and how long you can keep it going. So that's a cool everyday thing. Mm-hmm. So you can like look to the items in your house when you go home and maybe think, oh, maybe I should turn that light off. That takes a lot of power or effort to make that turn on.
All right. I am duly convinced I should do a better job of turning off lights. Let's bring into the conversation Emily Johnson. She is a senior at Olathe North High School, and with some of her fellow students, she won the Battle of the Brains competition to have a significant role in this exhibit. Emily, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit more specifically about what your particular role in the project and in this exhibit.
Well, I was a member of the team who wrote up the project and kind of wrote down all of our ideas and what we wanted to, you know, have in the exhibit. And I was the one who wrote the paper that we submitted to Burns & McDonnell as kind of the main pitch mm-hmm. for our design.
So everything you did was on paper. You didn't build the project. You put it on paper. But then one day you walk into Science City and everything you talked about building is there in real life.
Exactly. It was kind of surreal Friday walking in and seeing the power wheel and seeing the bikes and seeing our unplugged sign light up like that. And it was really amazing.
I guess I'm curious what motivated you to invest all of this time and energy, if you will, in something that is so, well, if you don't mind my saying so, brainy.
Right. Well, it was really important for us to be able to spread our love of science to kids and be able to educate them about something that goes on every day and, you know, in a fun way that they'd be able to remember.
Jeff Rosenblatt of Science City, what has been the reaction so far to the exhibit? It opened on Friday, you said.
It's been great. It's packed with people as they're coming through. It was a busy weekend for us, so it was a nice time to see how it works with a lot of people going through. But from the young children who are just turning the cranks to create electricity to getting on the bikes, a lot of the adults get on that, so even the adults can get involved. So it's kind of an all-ages thing, which is part of our goal. That everybody can be involved in the exhibit.
Well, we want to invite our callers, if any of them have been to the exhibit or are planning to go to the exhibit. What are you excited about? What did you like best? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org, or you can post on KCUR's Facebook page. Emily, what do you find to be the most sort of compelling lesson that's on display in this exhibit? What do you think is most fascinating about energy that kids will connect with?
I think for me, it's just the fact that it's something you use every day. You know, you run and you're creating energy, and a lot of kids don't realize that. But as soon as they kind of step on that wheel and see that they're creating energy, I think that's something that's really going to stick with them for a long time.
Yeah, that they actually are part of something bigger.
Right.
Yeah. Jeff, is the idea here to create just sort of these amazing things that kids can do with energy, or are you actually hoping that they will change their behavior as a result of what they learn?
Yeah. The intent of the Science Center in general is that people learn something new, or maybe they learn something again in a new way, a new perspective. So, yeah, the hope is that there is something to take away, whether it inspires them to have a career in science, or whether it inspires them to think differently or change their daily habits. So, at this exhibit, we do have a lot of emphasis on solar and wind. So the renewable sources, we have a cityscape of Kansas City that has wind turbines and solar panels placed outside of the city that actually powers the buildings.
So how does that how do you demonstrate that? How do you show a kid who may not know a thing about energy at all to what how do you connect what's happening there? Is it a model?
Yeah, it's a stylized model of the city. So the buildings are made out of this white plex that has a light inside. So for the H&R Block building, it's a green light because it's a green building. So as you turn a crank, which creates wind, which then turns these turbines, as more turbines come on, more buildings light up. So it's a very intuitive process, and that's what we try to design most exhibits to be intuitive. You don't have to read any signage if you don't want to. You just start playing with the exhibit, and then you see a direct effect of what you're doing. And with the solar panels, they can angle, and one of the controls angles them, and there's another control that actually increases the brightness of the sun, which is modeled up above the exhibit. So as they
do that...
That
would be nice if we could do that. That would solve a lot of problems.
It would totally be nice. Just make the sun a little brighter, right? Well, maybe not. But so they can have that, and there's just a direct effect to what they're doing. And the exhibits go from the kind of the traditional hands-on, it's there, and then we have a big, huge digital media wall, which has a map of the world. So you can see world energy consumption and production, and that's definitely for young children to connect with visually, but also for adults and the older students, say high school students, to come and really see it in a very engaging way.
How important was the work that the high school students, Emily's classmates, did on this project?
It was extremely important. It was the vision that we basically based the whole exhibit off of. We made a couple slight adjustments, but it pretty much, we feel, and seeing it there, and I think the students echoed it, it's the core of kind of what they wanted to have for that exhibit.
Emily, how long did this process of design and bringing it to fruition take?
Well, we won in November of 2011, so all throughout that year and over the summer, we had various meetings about locations and design and, you know, just kind of bringing it all together. So it's been a while, but it's been a good journey.
How many students were involved?
Around 30.
Okay, and you've been part of this now then for 2 years,
right?
Since you were a junior?
Right, that's right.
So how have you grown or changed as a result of this work? I mean, the goal is to help people understand the impact that their own energy use has on the world. Do you live differently because of what you know about energy?
I do. I find that, you know, if I walk into a room and the lights are on, I kind of switch them off. Or if I see, you know, a faucet running while someone's brushing their teeth, I kind of, you know, throw that off, because you do see that we waste a lot of energy, and it's, you know, not easy to come by. So it's definitely something that I've tried to, you know, reduce my consumption of energy.
Have you actually run on the human hamster wheel? I know that's not what it's called.
Power wheel.
Yeah. The power wheel, sorry. Did you produce a lot of energy?
It's harder than you'd think, and especially when you see the calorie counter, it's a lot harder to burn one calorie than you'd think.
Does not replace going to the gym regularly. Huh?
No.
I guess I'm wondering, Jeff, is the exhibit here for the long term?
Yeah, it's a permanent exhibit at the Science Center. We have basically a minimum 10-year lifetime on it. I anticipate components of this lasting definitely more than 10 years, probably 20 years or more. So some of these could be permanent pieces for the Science Center for a long, long time.
We'll still be using energy 10 or 20 years from now.
We still will be using energy.
Emily, yeah. I'm curious about your own plans. To win a competition called the Battle of the Brains is pretty heady stuff. What are your plans after high school?
I'm interested in chemistry. I'm not sure what college I'm going to yet, but it's definitely a subject I'm going to pursue.
Well, very good. So I understand the school got a $50,000 grant because of your good work. What's that going to?
We have spent it on some new instrumentation, but we plan to spend most of it on building smaller scale models of some of what's at Science City. We can take them around to different elementary schools or set them up in libraries so people can see them without, you know, having to go down to Science City necessarily.
Okay. Then that's an important piece of this project, right, Jeff?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what they do is some awesome stuff. Kind of what we do, we have an outreach program where you take out science demos or equipment, and so you can show some of the same concepts that would be at the Science Center and take them out to people. So that's really important to do. It's important for us, and it's great to see other schools like Olathe North doing things like that.
The few seconds we have left, this is not the only thing at Science City.
No.
What else will folks find if they want to spend part of the weekend down there?
Tons of super cool stuff. I could say that.
There you go.
We have lots of neat exhibits. One we recently opened in March is called Science on a Sphere. It's a 6-foot sphere with projection on it, information from the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration. So you can see all these different films and data sets of the Earth, of the planets, and you can kind of pick what you want to see, and we have live shows in there. We have a relocated nature center that's totally new. It's an awesome place to go check it out. And a lot of old exhibits, oldie but goodie exhibits, you can come see anytime. So tons of fun.
Very good. That's Jeff Rosenblatt. He's director of Science City and Gottlieb Planetarium, Kansas City's Science Center down at Union Station. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me here.
And thanks also to Emily Johnson, senior at Olathe North High School. And congratulations on winning the Battle of the Brains.
Thank you very much.
You can find out more about both our guests, all of our guests today, and all of our past broadcasts, too, at our website, kcur.org. Tune in tomorrow as we dig 6 feet deep into the curious history of famous corpses. Up to Date is next with a look at the book Who Stole the American Dream in an interview with Tom Sullivan. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Claire McInerney. I'm Brian Ellison, and this is Central Standard.